Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Is all that economic toiling by the central bank starting to create new bubble trouble? Today, some worrisome fallout from the Federal Reserve's fresh stimulus moves. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact Event Marketing, working to help small businesses and nonprofits make their events easier with event registration and marketing tools. ConstantContact.com. And by Progressive Insurance, with more than 30,000 local independent agents. Information available at progressive.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Rizdahl. On this day, we salute the sacrifices of those who have served us all this Veterans Day, November 11, 2010. We still strive for global unity, but the U.S. isn't too popular as the G20, the group of 20 nations, gathered today in South Korea. They're trying to hash out a plan for global economic cooperation, but many aren't happy with the Federal Reserve's moves to start pouring $600 billion into our economy to lower interest rates. Several developing countries fear the money will cause inflation and financial bubbles. And they may have a point. As Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith reports, the Fed's policy hasn't even taken effect, but it's already pumping up some asset prices here at home.
The Fed's quantitative easing plan may have been announced last week, but everybody's pretty much known about it since August. Bill Stone, chief investment strategist for PNC Wealth Management, calls it
the worst-kept secret ever. Everyone knew it was coming. It was really just a question of how much they would do.
Stone says expectations of the Fed's policy have been moving markets since the summer. Interest rates have stayed low, reducing returns on traditionally safe investments like bonds and treasury bills. And that, he says,
forces money out into riskier areas like stocks.
That's exactly what's been happening, says Nariman Baravesh, chief economist at IHS.
Households, pension funds, and mutual funds started to pile in big time into the stock market, and that has pushed up the market quite a lot.
About 700 points. That's how much the Dow Jones Industrial Average has risen since August. Investors have also been trying to get ahead of the Fed's move by going for gold. Literally. Commodities analyst Dan Montrenac.
Quantitative easing feeds fear of future inflation. It's seen as just basically printing money. Gold is always a good hedge against inflation because no government can print more gold.
Montrenac says gold prices have risen more than 20% since August. The surge of cash into the commodities market has raised concerns about a bubble. This week, the Chicago Mercantile Exchange raised the cost of trading to try and deter speculators. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace.
The British government has unveiled the most radical shakeup of the welfare state since the 1940s. Welfare recipients who refuse to take a job will lose their benefits. The government says the reform will ensure that people will always be better off in work than on welfare. The measures aren't just about saving money. They're also designed to tackle the so-called entitlement culture. From London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
Britain's Work and Pensions Minister Ian Duncan-Smith says that too many people here live on benefits as a lifestyle choice, and that's got to stop.
Under this government, choosing not to work if you can work is no longer an option.
Any able-bodied person who turns down work may lose their benefits for up to 3 years. But, says Duncan-Smith, he'll also ensure that nobody loses out because they've taken a job.
We will make work pay and support you through that work programme that we are creating.
Welfare will be less attractive. Claimants will have to do unpaid community work. The opposition Labour Party has attacked the plan. Spokesman Douglas Alexander says it will fail because there are 2 million unemployed in Britain and a further 600,000 jobs could soon go due to other government spending cuts.
Without work, this approach won't work. There are 5 claimants looking for every single vacancy in the job market at the moment.
But the move has been welcomed by Mark Littlewood of the Free Market Institute for Economic Affairs. He says the plan draws inspiration from the US.
Some of the efforts that have been made in welfare reform in America, particularly in the state of Wisconsin, have shown remarkable results by actually making sure that there is both a carrot and a stick approach to people who are on welfare rolls.
But he concedes that Britain is more heavily dependent on welfare than America. Weaning British claimants off their benefits will be more painful. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Attention Walmart shoppers, those who buy gifts on its website won't have to pay a dime for shipping this holiday season. It's following in the footsteps of competitors like Amazon, Borders, and Target, hoping it can boost online sales. But when a retailer like Walmart, with thousands of big box stores, decides to trade bricks for clicks, will it lose out on impulse purchases? As Marketplace's David Gurrow reports, online retailers want consumers to browse virtual aisles.
Something happens when you go inside an actual Walmart that usually doesn't happen when you shop online.
People will go to a store for one or two items, and they'll pick up 10 other items along the way.
Sucharita Mulperu is with Forrester Research. A Walmart or a Best Buy or a Barnes & Noble is full of stuff, and stores have gimmicks to get you to buy it. Big signs, product displays, two-for-one deals. Analyst Candice Corlett says online retailers are trying to be just as browser-friendly, or just as dangerous to the impulsive consumer.
Will the basket be as large as if a shopper were to go in the store? Maybe not. But we are getting to the point where browsing on the store's website is something that's as common as browsing the aisles when you're in the physical store.
Websites give you suggestions.
Here's what you bought last time. Here's what's on sale now. Here's what people who bought what you bought have also bought.
And Sucharita Mulperu says the key to every one of those recommendations is data. Sites keep track of what you look at, how long you spend on each page, and what you've purchased.
They all have kind of their army of PhDs who are there helping them kind of make the most of the traffic that they have on their websites.
A company like Amazon.com, which has been at the online retail game for a long time, has amassed tons of valuable information. Walmart is playing catch-up. With free shipping now, it's trying to take some of Amazon.com's market share, and it's hoping to learn more about how people shop. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Wall Street tumbled today, but traders were able to pick themselves up, dust off, and recover some of those losses. Details when we do the numbers. Balancing the budget is going to be expensive, so who's going to pay for it? The bipartisan leaders of the President's Deficit Commission have put a dramatic plan on the table. It's aimed at cutting $4 trillion worth of government deficits over 10 years. Democrat Erskine Bowles and Republican Alan Simpson envision big cuts in defense spending, health care, and Social Security benefits. For every $3 of spending cuts, the plan raises another dollar in taxes. John Dimsdale has been going over the details in Washington. Hey, John.
Hello, Bob.
So what are these two commissioners proposing to do on the tax front?
Well, their idea is that if you get rid of all the convoluted tax deductions and exclusions and the special treatments for certain favored activities, like the mortgage interest deduction or the child tax credit, you expand the number of people who pay taxes, and you can bring down overall rates. You can drop middle-class tax rates, for example, from 28 to 14%, and on the wealthy, from 35 to 23%.
Now, under this, would taxes hit different income groups the same as they do now? In other words, would the wealthy bear the progressive share of government revenues compared to the poor and the middle class?
It's really hard to say. Largely, it should be true because the rich are the biggest beneficiaries of these tax breaks that would disappear. They'd lose a lot of advantages, especially the very wealthy who get a lot of income from capital gains and stock dividends, because under this proposal, those would be taxed like regular income. But who wins and who loses almost comes down to individual cases, the size of your mortgage, the size of your family, how much do you spend on health care, how much of your income is from capital gains versus a salary. You start picking winners and losers, and you provoke a lot of opposition. And the problem is, according to Bill Gale at the Tax Policy Center, any real solution has to mean more losers than winners.
People are comparing the proposal to the status quo, and they're liking the status quo better. The problem is the status quo is not sustainable. This is what a solution looks like, and people have to get used to the fact that their taxes are going to go up and their benefits are going to go down.
Interesting, but I wonder, John, how realistic are the chances a proposal like this can win approval?
Well, it's been panned from all sides of the political spectrum, but a lot of economists say it's a serious starting point, that this sets a high bar for all future debt reduction ideas. But, you know, there's very little weight behind this. It's only a draft. It's not the final commission report, which doesn't come out until December 1st. And even that won't be binding on Congress, so there's still a long way to go.
Stay tuned. Our D.C. Bureau Chief John Dimsdale, thank you.
Thanks, Bob.
There are a lot of numbers that don't translate well for radio, but we've got some charts showing those new tax brackets and rates at marketplace.org. Republicans in Congress have talked a lot about rolling back the health care reform law, and today the White House signaled President Obama would block that with his veto pen. But a lot of the action over the next few years will be at the state level. States have a lot of leeway in implementing the law, and Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has been checking the public pulse now that Republicans will control both the governor's mansions and legislatures in 20 states.
Many of the Republicans who swept into state offices pledged to fight the new health care law. Maine's governor-elect said voters would read about him telling President Obama to, quote, go to hell. Now, the new GOP governors and lawmakers can't take down the health care law, but they can be miserly with the staff and resources needed to implement it. Alan Weil is executive director of the National Academy for State Health Policy.
They'll have the rules on the books, but they may not enforce them as actively as some other states.
Rules on setting up exchanges where people can shop for health insurance. The federal government has basic requirements for insurers who want to sell their wares on the exchanges. States can make insurers cover extra stuff, like fertility treatments. Conservative state officials prefer a free market approach, letting most insurers into the exchanges. They think that'll bring down prices. And speaking of price, some states already require insurers to get approval for a rate hike. The free marketers don't like that idea either. Deborah Cholet is a health economist at Mathematica Policy Research.
They are reluctant to become more aggressive managers of their health insurance market, or they're simply waiting to see what happens.
What'll eventually happen if they hold back is the federal government will step in. For example, the health care law sets some limits on premium increases. And if states refuse to set up the insurance exchanges altogether, the feds will organize and run them. States that do cooperate get rewarded with federal grants to implement the new law. Even some sitting governors who spoke out against the law have applied for and taken the cash. Len Nichols is a health economist at George Mason University.
It's one thing to campaign. It's another thing to actually see the cold, hard facts of where the money will flow.
If you can't beat them, don't just join them. Take their money, too. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Coming up, when it comes to what you'll be leaving behind when you're gone, preparing for deportation is serious business.
It is as important as a will because you need to have a plan in place for your children.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 73 points, 2/3%, to finish at 11,283. The NASDAQ dropped 23 points, or 0.9%, to wrap up at 2555. The S&P 500 lost 5 points, 0.4%, to finish at 1213. Cisco Systems plunged 16% after the tech company reported their expected quarterly earnings were, quote, not in the bag. Cisco's CEO blamed it on air pockets in the economy that surprised him, but vowed to fly through the trouble. Another dim day for financials. Bank of America cashed out 1.2%. J.P. Morgan Chase, Citigroup, and Wells Fargo unloaded 1.3% each. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. By Microsoft, providing comprehensive business solutions for the cloud. You can learn more at Microsoft.com/cloud. And by Vanguard, whose mission is to simplify investing and to help people reach their financial goals at vanguard.com/public radio. If you missed the broadcast, you can still catch Marketplace. Go to our website and click on Podcasts. You'll also find our new podcasts, The Midday Update, Freakonomics, and The Tech Report, all at marketplace.org. From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Labor Department reports on extended mass layoffs for the third quarter. That's when 50 or more employees from a single company lose their jobs for at least 31 days. President Obama begins the last portion of his 10-day Asia trip. He'll be in Japan. And happy birthday, Neil Young. He'll be 65. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Rizdahl. First glances can be deceiving if you skim past this morning's headline on foreclosures. Yes, the rate did fall in October, and it's tempting to read that as fewer homeowners are struggling. But RealtyTrack says the numbers were skewed by the logjam over questionable paperwork. Despite complaints that unqualified workers have been signing off on thousands of foreclosures per month, banks seem to be keeping the bar rather low. Marian Wang is a reporter and blogger at ProPublica. She's been checking some job listings posted for foreclosure experts. Marian, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So what types of qualifications does one need to be a specialist in foreclosures?
It tends to vary depending on who's hiring. We looked at, for instance, GMAC, now Ally Financial, and that bank, for instance, was hiring a foreclosure specialist and wanted a college degree and 3 to 4 years of experience. But then Chase, for instance, was hiring a quality specialist, someone who would make sure that foreclosures were processed correctly, and they were only asking for high school diplomas. So it really depended.
And is it necessarily required that you should have a higher skill set to understand what's going on with these foreclosure documents?
That was the criticism, and that was a lot of what came out after the foreclosure scandal blew up, is that a lot of them weren't particularly educated. And we don't know, but perhaps that would have helped. I think a lot of the problem with the, you know, so-called Burger King kids, as they were called at J.P. Morgan, was that they, in many cases, didn't even know what a mortgage was. I mean, to be fair, it is very highly technical, but something like an affidavit, which you are handling every single day, you should know what that is and know how to process it.
Now, the jobs that you looked at, is it clear where those workers are going?
In many cases, it was. Like, for instance, the one that we saw with GMAC was pretty clear. And Chase, we saw one from Chase that was looking also only for high school education. But some of them with the staffing agencies, it is really unclear where they're going. I talked to one of them, and the staffing agency seemed to be hiring for a foreclosure law firm, like some of the ones that we have been seeing and hearing about and are currently being investigated.
What should these banks be looking for? What does it actually take, do you think, to process these kinds of foreclosure documents?
I mean, it definitely requires someone who can communicate well. I think that has been one of the main problems with this process, is that you have one arm of the bank trying to help the homeowner stay in his or her home, and you have another arm that is trying to work on behalf of the banks or investors to try and foreclose. A lot of people are very skeptical right now. Judges, as well as foreclosure defense attorneys, are just skeptical that even if they hire more people and refile these documents, that the problem will actually be fixed, because it is, in their opinion, a much deeper structural problem.
Marian Wang is a reporter and blogger at ProPublica. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, this is encouraging. Applications for jobless benefits hit a four-month low last week. That ray of hope today from the Labor Department is a sign that employers are starting to hire again. Iowa Public Radio's Sarah McCammon visited a job fair in Des Moines today. She found companies are looking to add jobs, although many of them are temporary. But short-term or not, that can still be seen as a good sign.
A half hour before this Veterans Day job fair officially started, job seekers were already lining up in the atrium of the county building hosting the fair. A year ago, state officials canceled the event because of lackluster response from companies looking to hire. This year, organizers had hoped for 20. Instead, they got more than 50 business and college recruiters to sign up. One of them was temporary placement company Action Staffing Services of Des Moines. Corbin Kinney is the recruiting manager.
Last year we were bringing in candidates, but we didn't have jobs. Now we're bringing in more jobs, and we actually have candidates at this point.
Kinney is looking to fill about 15 positions now and says he's steadily hearing from companies needing to fill temporary jobs in fields like finance, construction, and warehousing. According to Labor Department data, the economy added nearly 500,000 temporary jobs over the past 12 months. That's good news for people like Robert Rockwell, who's 21 and lives in Des Moines. He's been looking for work since losing his job at a hotel, and he'd like to work in customer service again. But mostly, he just wants a job.
A temp job is better than being unemployed. You know, I can't complain about any opportunity that comes my way.
But not everyone is happy with the prospect for temp work. Alan Moon, 54, is from Dexter, Iowa, with a background in real estate tax. He's been looking for a job since August.
My intent is to get a job that I can stay in and not have to be looking for a job again.
If past recessions are any indication, Moon may not have to wait long, says Steve Burcham of the American Staffing Association. In previous downturns, permanent hiring has usually picked up 3 to 6 months after temporary hiring starts to rise. But Burcham cautions this time the lag may be longer. Employers are still not certain conditions have improved enough for permanent hiring.
That nervousness has been more prolonged, perhaps because the recession was significantly deeper than anything we've had since the Great Depression.
Still, for many job seekers attending this fair, a temporary job is more than they had yesterday. In Des Moines, I'm Sarah McCammon for Marketplace.
What happens to your money and other possessions after you're gone? Normally, that's a question dealt with in a will, preparing in advance by deciding now who gets what. But the very same issues can apply much earlier in life for undocumented immigrants. As deportations have increased, they face a struggle to protect their assets before they're gone from the country. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports.
For undocumented immigrants, one misstep can result in disaster. Ismael Martinez Neri lived in the U.S. for 12 years. Then, one night, he was stopped by police in Georgia for a broken taillight. It led to his being put into deportation proceedings. Bad enough for him, but worse for his son, who doctors had put on a waiting list for a heart transplant.
As soon as they found out that I was in removal proceedings, they took him out of the list because they were concerned about who will provide transportation to my son after the transplant.
He was unprepared for his own deportation, let alone the implications for his very sick son. This despite the fact that activists have been warning for years that people need to make tough financial decisions in advance and make arrangements.
It is as important as a will because you need to have a plan in place for your children.
Maria Odom is executive director at the Catholic Legal Immigration Network.
Who is going to receive and have the resources to take care of that child? Do I want to create an emergency fund in the event that I am detained so that that temporary custodian can properly take care of my child?
Rafael, who owns a two-bedroom house in Riverside, California, has similar concerns. I agreed not to use Rafael's last name because right now he has no legal right to be in the U.S., although he spent most of his life here.
When I get here, I was 17 years old. I'm 42, 43 years old now.
For 20 years, he had a job at a lumberyard. Then his worker's permit expired. Through a series of legal missteps, he faces deportation to Mexico. Just like many undocumented immigrants, Rafael is entrusting the family's assets to his American children.
My kids decide to stay and try to see if they can afford it to pay the house.
If Rafael is suddenly deported, his daughter has access to his bank account. She plans to hold on to the house where they've lived for more than 10 years. Other families that have not prepared end up liquidating assets in a fire sale. Javier Maldonado is an immigration lawyer in San Antonio.
These folks have accumulated quite a bit of equity in their home, or they have vehicles, and they have nothing else in their home country. And so they need access to that money.
Planning ahead can help immigrants get ready for deportation, but preparation also makes it easier to avoid it. This requires a lawyer. Many offer their services for free, but demand for legal services exceeds supply. Maria Odom says the cost varies widely from city to city.
It would be several thousand dollars. It would be a serious investment on the part of the person who's in deportation proceedings.
Fighting deportation is easier when a person can establish that they've been conscientious about paying their taxes. Outside the courthouse in Atlanta, I spoke to Sarah Owings, the lawyer representing Ismael Martinez-Neri.
Fortunately, Mr. Martinez-Neri had a tax identification number and had been paying some taxes.
Owings says the courts take tax payments seriously. They're like an investment in this country.
Anyone can get a tax identification number. It does not require you to have legal status here, and the IRS will gladly take your money.
The court showed mercy on Martinez. Because of his son's hardship, he was allowed to stay in the country legally. He's now working to get his son placed back on the list for a heart transplant. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reputation Defender, helping doctors, lawyers, and small business owners monitor, protect, and improve their online reputations. ReputationDefender.com. By Toyota. Toyota is sharing technology and ideas for a better world. Learn more at toyota.com/ideas for good. And by Putnam Investments, dedicated to helping financial advisors and their clients pursue a more comfortable retirement. You can get the latest at RothIRAblog.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
A final note, General Electric has just revved up interest in the emerging market for electric cars. The company announced today it will buy 25,000 electric vehicles within the next 5 years. Initially, GE will purchase 12,000 GM vehicles, starting with the Chevy Volt. It's not just that it makes sense for a company with electric in its name. GE hopes to spur interest because it makes charging stations and other infrastructure that could bring in hundreds of millions in revenue. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow fell 73 points, 2/3%. The Nasdaq dropped 23 points, or 9/10%. The S&P 500 lost 5 points, 4/10%. Ben Adair, John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Hawes, Jonathan Karp, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Next time on this program, pop-up stores. They're convenient for shoppers and strategic gold for retailers.
It's really, I think, about capturing the consumer's first impulse to make a purchase and prevent those dollars from going to competition.
The not-so-temporary trend of pop-up shops. I'm Bob Moon. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.